calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
Well, we've nailed him. We've figured out who did it. This is incredible. The progressives in the United States and conservatives in the United States had come together trying to figure out who is the senator, the unidentified senator, who placed a hold on Barack Obama and Tom Coburn. Coburn is a Republican, Obama, of course, a Democrat. These two senators had put together a piece of legislation saying, we ought to be able, we the people of America, not just the Senate, we the people ought to be able to figure out how our tax dollars are being spent. Last year, $2.5 trillion. So don't you think we ought to have the right to figure it out? And it was passed unanimously out of committee, this piece of legislation saying, let's put together a Google-like database. Anybody can go in and just search the thing. You want to know how much money is being spent on bridges to nowhere? You want to know how much money is being spent on the George W. Bush Memorial Chicken Coop in Rawson, Oklahoma? I mean, you know, whatever it may be, you can just Google it. You can figure it out instantly. That the federal budget would no longer be secret, and a senator put a secret hold on it. Welcome to the program, and top of the morning, afternoon, whatever it may be to you. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live. I'm actually broadcasting today from the studios of The Quake, KQKE, in San Francisco, California, where last night I went to the screening of a new movie, Crude Impact, which is not in release yet. This was the director's cut screening kind of thing. It was a private screening, probably 100 people there who were affiliated with the movie in one way or another. And just a great new documentary that I'm in, and I'm looking forward to seeing this thing in theaters. I believe crudeimpact.com is the website. If not, you can certainly Google it fairly quickly. So anyhow, this is the breaking story right now. Who was the senator? And in fact, one of the things that I find fascinating about this is that I was getting, you know, I'm all these right wing email lists. And I was getting from conservative alerts, this right-wing group that is, you know, always sending stuff out. I was getting all this stuff about, we've got to figure out who it is that's doing this, and quack. The right wing, rightmarch.com actually is their website. And going on and on about, you know, hey, some senator, I think that they thought it was a Democrat who'd done it. I mean, it's the only thing I can come up with. And then, of course, you had, you know, on the other side, you had progressives saying, hey, you know, aren't we entitled? Right across the political spectrum, this is what amazed me. Right across the political spectrum, people were saying, who is this toxic senator who has put a hold on this piece of legislation that was unanimously passed by the Republicans and the Democrats on the committee and passed out it should have come before the full Senate for a vote. But see, senators have the ability to put a hold on a piece of legislation, essentially to kill it, it stops it. And not only can they hold it publicly, an individual senator can say, I'm going to put a hold on it. Public hold, for example, Ron Wyden right now. There's a piece of legislation that would do away with net neutrality, that would allow the big telecom companies to say, if you want to have your information delivered quickly over the Internet, you have to pay extra fee to AT&T and Verizon. And, of course, the phone companies and the cable companies and who carry an awful lot of the Internet traffic now on their systems, they're pushing so hard to do away with network neutrality and replace it with this multi-tiered system where they can, you know, a pay-to-play system, basically, where the giant corporate websites will always load really, really fast on your PC. But, you know, the smaller, for example, progressive websites like, you know, Think Progress or BuzzFlash or Op-Ed News or, on and on, that if they want to load fast, they have to pay an extra couple hundred thousand bucks a year, whatever. I mean, whatever the fee may be. Companies will come up with it, and there's nobody to appeal to.
It's the free market.
Yeah, right. So anyhow, Ron Wyden put a hold on that piece of legislation. Now, what that means is that it takes 60 senators to break that hold. A hold on a piece of legislation is functionally a filibuster. For all practical purposes, it's a filibuster. You're blocking legislation. So it would not be incorrect to say that right now, Ron Wyden, to his credit, God bless him, Democratic senator from Oregon, Senator Ron Wyden, is filibustering the attempts to do away with network neutrality for the Internet. Good on him. So the question was, who is the senator who is filibustering, who has put a hold? Only he didn't do it in public. He did it secretly, because senators have the right to put a secret hold on legislation. Who is the senator who put the secret hold on this piece of legislation that would create this easily accessible database of all federal spending that anybody could go in and basically search the way you search Google? And just maybe an hour ago, we found out, surprise of surprises, one of the most toxic senators in the United States Senate, Senator Ted Stevens of Alaska. Gee. I'm just astounded. He hasn't actually admitted that he's done it. But what they did is both liberal groups and conservative groups working together went to the office of every senator. And the conservative groups would ask the Republicans and the liberal groups would ask the Democrats, Senator Smith, did you put a hold on this? Senator Cantwell, did you put a hold on this? Senator, right on down the list. There's 100 senators, and they asked every single one of them. And the conservative groups were asking the Republican senators, and the liberal groups were asking the Democratic senators. And so the senators felt some need to respond, some pressure to respond. And 99 senators in the United States Senate said, no, I didn't do it. And only one senator said, I ain't telling. So while Ted Stevens, the Republican from Alaska, has not admitted that he's the guy who doesn't want you and me to know how federal dollars are being spent, I'd say it's a safe guess. Now, why would Ted Stevens do that? Why would he be the only senator blocking this piece of legislation, a one-man filibuster with this secret hold? Why? Well, as the Center for American Progress over Think Progress notes, in 2005, last year, just as an example of how Ted Stevens is probably the most prolific earmarker in the entire United States Senate, you know, coming up with these little, we'll just put this little earmark in here, tossing specific appropriation language into pieces of legislation that say not only the government shall spend $42 million to do thus and so, but, it shall spend it with Acme Company. I mean, the earmarks allow senators and congressmen, for that matter, but in particular the Senate here, earmarks allow senators to direct money not just to particular projects, not just even to particular states, but to particular companies. They could just, have dinner with the president of Acme Widget Company Monday night and Tuesday morning. They can attach an earmark, making sure that Acme Company gets an extra $40 million in federal contracts. I mean, that's how sick and twisted and weird it's become. And one of the most prolific of the earmark, and this, by the way, surprise, surprise, and a product of the Republican-owned and led Senate and House. I mean, the ability to do this has theoretically been around forever, but these guys have turned it into an art form, starting with Reagan, but really kicking the doors down 5 years ago when Bush was installed in office by the Supreme Court. I mean, that's when it really got kicked into high gear. Why? Well, because the Republicans believe that the quality of a nation is determined, is measured by the wealth and power of its most powerful institutions and wealthiest people. And Democrats and liberals generally believe that the wealth and power of a nation is determined by the quality and the wealth of its middle class. And they're a very simple difference in worldviews. So, of course, if they think that the wealthy institutions are the hallmark of how healthy a society is, they're going to do everything they can to give more money to the wealthy institutions. They've been doing it. So here's Ted Stevens. In 2005, he helped slip in legislation to begin construction on the Bridge to Nowhere. A $200 million earmark to bring a bridge to an island that has 50 people living on it. what is that, $4 million per person? Would that be right?
Yeah,
$4 million a person. And then when somebody proposed an amendment that would have defunded that, Stevens threatened to resign from the Senate. I mean, this is how bizarre it gets. There's a few other examples I'll share with you after the break. And get your take on this and a lot of other news of the day. A new piece up on Common Dreams that I wrote yesterday. Go to commondreams.org. You can see it. We'll be talking about that as well. What's up with the JonBenet Ramsey killing? 16 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number, toll-free across the United States, tomhartman.com, if you want to drop into our live chat room or participate in the discussions over at our blog, our message boards. Tom Coburn and Barack Obama put together this legislation that would have created this database, this national database, so that we could all figure out how our money is being spent. And oddly enough, progressives and liberals on the one side and conservatives and Republicans on the other side are looking at this going, this is a good idea. Everybody thought it was a good idea. Tom Coburn and Barack Obama put it together. And some senator put a hold on it. Turns out it was Ted Stevens of Alaska. It certainly appears to be. He's the only one so far who has refused to deny it. Now, here's where it gets interesting. Did he do this? Did Ted Stevens do this? Assuming that he did, and the evidence is pretty strong, I think we can safely assume that he did. Did Ted Stevens of Alaska do this because he's the earmark queen? Or should that be earmark king or earmark czar? I don't know. Earmark prostitute? Whatever. He's the guy who's just passing out money, right? The earmark hooker, that's what we'll call him that. Yeah. Did he do it for that reason? For example, last year, he tried to insert an amendment into the National Defense Bill allowing oil drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Area, one of his big, you know, pet projects. Why? Well, he says it's going to help us with our oil problem in the United States. Fact of the matter is, it's literally a drop in the bucket. What it's going to do is it's going to make billions of dollars. See, even a relatively small amount of oil, like in Anwar, still is billions of dollars, tens of billions of dollars, perhaps even hundreds of billions of dollars over a multi-decade period of time in profits for BP or Chevron or Texaco or ExxonMobil, whatever company it is that has been whining and dining Ted Stevens and therefore is going to get to the front of the line when Anwar gets opened up. It's not about supplying more oil to the United States. It's about supplying more profit to the oil companies, which, you know, is what Ted Stevens is all about. If some benefit accrues to Alaska as a consequence of that, even if it's a short-term benefit that gives Alaskans $1,000 at the end of the year as a kickback, but is helping take down the planet, including Alaskans who are watching their permafrost freeze. It's a small price to pay. After all, it guarantees you get reelected. So anyhow, in the Senate, they pulled this thing out. He tried to slap this amendment into a national defense bill. This is a bill, let's support the troops. Let's build some more, C-17 tankers or whatever. I mean, here's the defense bill. The whole Pentagon budget, and Stevens tries to slap into it, drilling in Anwar, and his colleagues in the Senate, including some Republicans, pulled the thing back out again. Said, no, you can't have this, Ted. Sorry. Not going to happen. He says, this is the saddest day of my life. And he has, speaking of his peers and associates in the Senate who removed this, who he had had cordial relationships with in the past, he says, I've written off their friendship. I mean, this is the guy who earmarked almost $500,000 to research baby food made from salmon and over $1 million for alternative salmon product research. It was the third year in a row. He's come up with money to research alternative salmon products or variations on salmon product. Now, what's that all about? What it's all about is he's got some folks in Alaska that he can figure out a way to get some money to. And, you know, I understand if I was a voter in Alaska, I would be saying, hey, you know, if I can get a little more federal money, what's wrong with that? I mean, this is the thing. At a certain level, and I know, you know, we're on the air here in KUDO in Kudo in Anchorage, Alaska. And you know, I would point out, I understand. You know, every district, every state in the country wants their representative, their senator, to represent them as well as possible and get as much money back to their district as possible from the federal pot. Ted Stevens has been pretty good at that. And at a certain point, you have to say, well, you know, is what's best for Alaska best for the United States? No, in this case. And is it even best for Alaska over the long term? No. And that's where it gets real. But in any case, so the big question, why did Stevens put the hold on this bill? Is it because he's the earmark hooker of the year? Or is it because it was Tom Coburn who put forward the legislation? Because it turns out that when Stevens tried to put his, you know, first put in his bridge to nowhere, we actually succeeded with it. The guy who tried to stop it was Tom Coburn, a Republican. And so, you know, Stevens is like really into revenge. And so apparently he's willing to tell the citizens of Alaska, you, citizens of Alaska, you are not entitled to know what is in the federal budget, because he's on a vendetta against Tom Coburn. Looks more like that's the case. 27 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Yes, if you wanna run, you got to run. Oh, baby, baby, if you run. Baby, baby, if you run.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. You're in the democracy zone, the no boring zone, the Tom Hartman radio program, 34 minutes past the hour. The Wall Street Journal reporting today. This is just astounds me. I just have to say, this just astounds me how honest, how blunt, how blasé they are about this. The Wall Street Journal reports, and I quote, President Bush will launch another major public relations offensive to strengthen support for the Iraq war, this time likely emphasizing the high stakes and changing nature of the battle more than the progress being made. They're not saying Bush is going to come out and tell us something of substance. It's not that Bush is going to reveal some new information. It's not that he's going to change policy. It's not that he has some new idea about how to save America and how to save the Middle East and how to stop this, you know, what are we, not 5% approval rating in Jordan and Egypt? The last time I was in Egypt was 5 years ago. Everywhere I went, oh, you're an American, one, welcome. Of course, you know, hey, you got some tourist dollars for me. But, I mean, you know, the bottom line, by and large, people in Egypt liked Americans. 5% approval rating now, 5 years later. So is Bush going to come out? He's going to announce something that he's going to do to try to bring us back into the good graces of the people of the Middle East. Forget about the wackos and the terrorists and the old bin Ladens. I mean, just the average on the street. If you can't win the street, you've lost the game. I mean, it's just that simple. No matter how many politicians you can buy off, no matter how many armies you've got, no matter how many bombs you drop, if you can't win the street, you have lost. Is Bush going to announce that he's come up with a plan to do this? Is he going to announce that we're going to start, you know, change our policies in some way that will allow us to, on the one hand, still accomplish our goals in the region, which is to secure our oil supply? He talks about democracy, but come on. The guy is kissing members of the Saudi royal family, which is one of the most treacherous and repressive dictatorships in the Middle East. Every Friday in Jeddah, they have public execution, public beheadings in the soccer stadium. Every Friday. Somehow you don't hear Bush talking about that. These are state-run beheadings. Oh, he's very enthusiastic about talking about these
people. Behead people is terrible.
Talking about the insurgents in Iraq.
Oh, wait, they beheaded this guy.
Yeah. Just show up at the soccer stadium in Jeddah or Riyadh every Friday. Watch him cut people's hands off and cut people's feet off. Watch him dig holes and put women in them up to their neck, cover their head with a cloth, and then everybody stands around and throws stones at them until their skulls are crushed and they're dead. So is he announcing that he's going to change policy? No, they are talking about the fact that he's going to launch a public relations offensive. We have reached the point in America where the news is that the president is going to launch a PR offensive. The news series of speeches begins tomorrow at the annual American Legion Convention in Utah and will continue through the 9/11 anniversary. Amazing. And meanwhile, we have covered many times in this program, you know, what went wrong in Ohio. We've had Mark Crispin Miller on, the author of Fooled Again. We've had Robert F. Kennedy Jr. on, talking about his article in Rolling Stone magazine or newspaper about how essentially Ken Blackwell engineered the theft of the 2004 election in Ohio. And that in all probability, John Kerry actually won Ohio. And certainly, if Blackwell hadn't done the same thing Catherine Harris did, which is throw hundreds of thousands of people off the voting rolls in Ohio, Kerry would have won Ohio, even given the fact that, you know, you had too few machines in largely Democratic precincts and lots of machines in the very beginning. So you had the 10-hour long lines, and then when people got to the front of the line, they were told, oh, last night we switched the district, you're supposed to be three blocks down the street in the public school instead of here at the library, and all the obstacles he threw in front of everybody. This from Raw Story, Larissa Alexandrova. Ohio officials will soon begin destroying the paper ballots from the 2004 presidential election, despite objections from voter rights groups, according to a story slated for Wednesday's edition of the New York Times. Ian Urbina writes for the Times, soon after the 2004 presidential election, questions emerged about how votes were tallied in Ohio, a battleground state that delivered the presidency to George W. Bush. Now, following a routine procedure, state officials are preparing to destroy the paper ballots from the elections, writes Urbina. Critics say the ballots should be preserved for more study, the article in the New York Times continues. Yeah. And over at Raw Story, Right. In related news, an email written by 2004 Democratic presidential nominee Senator John Kennedy. This has the right wing all out there hysterical. I mean, you know, Tucker Carlson yesterday. Oh, he's going to win, but they're talking about Ohio and Kerry. John Kerry sent out a letter, an email, to 100,000 Democratic donors on Tuesday, urging them to support Congressman Ted Strickland. He's a guy who's running for governor of Ohio against Ken Blackwell, the Republican Secretary of State and Republican Chairman of the re-elect George Bush Committee in Ohio, who basically oversaw the theft of the vote. And in that email, John Kerry says of Ken Blackwell, the Republican who is running for governor of Ohio, quote, he used the power of his state office to try to intimidate Ohioans and suppress the Democratic vote, end quote. Now, the cons are all running around going, oh, John Kerry, he's complaining about the 2004 election. Quit whining. Get over it. No, he's pointing out that this guy, what this guy did. And frankly, I don't hear Ken Blackwell denying it. Have we reached the point in the United States where intimidating voters and suppressing the vote of a particular political party is acceptable behavior? This is just incredible. Kerry, at the Martin Luther King Day, Martin Luther King Jr. Memorial Breakfast in Boston back in January of last year. I mean, just at the surface stuff. He says thousands of people were suppressed in their efforts to vote. Voting machines were distributed in uneven ways. I mean, it's a very simple thing. I remember so clearly, I'll tell you, on election night, November 2004, I was doing election coverage. We were living in Vermont at the time. I was doing a national radio show, but there was a local station, WDEV, which is one of the affiliates that carries this program. And so I volunteered. I mean, they were just down the road from me. Station's run by a great guy, Ken Squire, old friend, and just a brilliant old radio guy. And I shouldn't say old, brilliant radio guy. And so Ken and I are doing election coverage. And 10 o'clock or so Eastern time, 10, 10:30, something like that, the word comes down from the Associated Press that the exit polls are showing that Kerry has won the election in a landslide, millions and millions of votes, including Ohio. That is, the whole thing is being handed off to Kerry. And that Karen Hughes has sat George W. Bush down in the White House and said, sorry, sir. And that Bush seemed untroubled by it. So I reported that. I was doing the election coverage there from WDEV. And a half hour later, an hour later, the story comes down. Nope, oops, Kerry lost. So now in Ohio, Ken Blackwell, he's going to destroy the ballots. They're trying to destroy the evidence. That's incredible. So, just look at what's going on here. Ted Stevens putting a secret hold on a piece of legislation. Ken Blackwell trying to steal another election. John Kerry calls him on it, and the media is going nuts. There'll be a story about this in the New York Times tomorrow, about how the Bushevics are trying to destroy the evidence of their crimes in Ohio. And then on top of all of this, the very elegant timing. You can see the piece I wrote about this for Common Dreams over at commondreams.org right now. The very elegant timing of the Department of Homeland Security apparently giving 4 hours notice to the prosecuting attorney or the district attorney in Boulder that she had to get an investigator over to Thailand to get this guy arrested, this John Mark Carr. Why? Because a federal judge, it appears that this is the why. The what happened is not in dispute. Federal Judge Anna Diggs Taylor declared that George W. Bush, on the same day the John Mark Carr story broke, declared that George W. Bush had committed felonies, a series of as many as 30 felonies, each of which could earn him 5 years in prison and a $10,000 fine. And the law specifically says that federal officials can be prosecuted for this. It specifically says this. In fact, I hear reading from the law, quote, there is federal jurisdiction over an offense under this section if the person committing the offense was an officer or employee of the United States at the time the offense was committed. I mean, she comes right out and says, she says, in this case, the president has acted undisputedly as FISA forbids, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. This is the law. And if you go back and you read the FISA law, it says anybody who breaks the FISA law will be subject to, quote, a fine of not more than $10,000 or imprisonment for not more than 5 years or both. So from Ted Stevens covering up, you know, putting on hold this piece of legislation to have a database that conservatives and progressives are agreeing we need to have on how federal spending is happening to covering the evidence of the crimes in Ohio, right across the board. Republicans going nuts this week, 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Oh, baby, baby, it's a wild world. It's hard to get by just upon a smile. Oh, baby, baby, it's a wild world. I'll always remember you like a child girl.
And welcome back. 10 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Oh, man. Was it Kara Phillips? Was that who Drudge was? I mean, he just, this poor woman, unzipped live from the ladies' room. I got to tell you, I used to teach marketing and communications, advertising, stuff like that, we would do workshops, seminars all around the country. And one of these things, you pay a couple $100 and show up for a day, and companies would send their people. It was a business that we ran out of Atlanta called the Newsletter Factory. We had five guys who were on the road doing these things. I owned the company, and I put together the curriculum, and I taught a lot of the seminars. And, Fortune 500 and all this kind of stuff. And so anyhow, I was with one of our instructors. His name was Dave. He and I were doing a workshop together. And we had these wireless mics on, which are really nice, a wireless mic. And during the break, and there was probably 100 people in the room, and probably two-thirds of them were women. And we went into the men's room, and there was a couple of guys in there there was this guy in there who says to Dave, "Hey, did you see the hooters on that woman, on that girl in the front row?" Or, actually his terms were even a little more derogatory, isn't the right word, sexist. And he's going off about this woman in the front row and her figure. And they're making jokes about it. And we leave the bathroom and walk back into the room. And here's 100 people with this shocked look on their face. "What?" I'm like, "What's this about?" And Dave says something, and his voice comes out of the speakers at 100 decibels. And I'm like, oh, man, now I know what happened. I just can't. I mean, that's the kind of stuff that, that's like the dreams about being naked in public kind of thing. I mean, this poor woman, give her a break. I mean, Drudge, take it off your website. Come on, give this woman a break. She's doing her best. I just, it's a tragic mistake. It's not worth destroying somebody's career over. KJ in Camas, Washington. Hey, KJ, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, did you hear that apparently the president of Iran has challenged our own George W. Bush to a televised debate?
Yes, we reported it here on this program yesterday or the day before.
Okay, I just thought it would be a great opportunity for him to present his case to the world.
I think it's... somehow I doubt that George W. Bush is ever going to debate anybody ever again.
Well, I ain't holding my breath.
Yeah. In large part because they figured out that when he does, he wears that wireless earpiece, on his back, and he can't afford to get busted for that again. So,
right.
It was pretty strange. Thanks a lot for the call, KJ. Joe in Brookings, Oregon. Hey, Joe, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, well, you got to cut Ted Stevens some slack. I mean, after all, up there in Alaska with their bridges to nowhere and their 200% voter turnout, I mean, you just got, some different rules up there. And, it's Ted Stevens, operating by some exceptional rules.
Yeah, this is the state where the governor can appoint his daughter as senator. But, on the one hand. On the other hand, there's a lot of good people in Alaska.
It's just that they
seem to have some very bizarre politicians.
Well, yes, but... what is this thing, what is it, just in the United States Senate, or can they do this in the House of Representatives too? Someone can put a hold on legislation like that?
A secret hold. I don't believe you can do a secret hold in the House. I think you can only do it in the Senate.
Well, I mean, they should get rid of that. I mean, that is totally anti-democratic and ridiculous.
I agree with you, Joe, and it's just all part of the whole, we're the Senate, we're the special club, we're the select few, we're the elite, in some ways they are. Mitch in Cleveland, and thanks for the call, Joe. Always good to hear from you. Mitch in Cleveland, Ohio. Hey, Mitch, what's up?
Hi, yeah. I just have a question about Ken Blackwell. Why wouldn't the Democratic Party or some activist, at least in the Democratic Party, give an injunction to stop him from him destroying those ballots?
Because he's within the law to do it. I would guess that probably Paul Leto from Washington State what's the guy's name who is running for governor actually this year in Ohio on the Green Party ticket. we've had him on our program, who, you know, in order to set it up so that he can have a lawsuit against them, that one of these guys will do something. I sure hope so. I mean, this story just, I just saw it for the first time maybe 2 hours ago, so it's just breaking, apparently. And whether something's going to come out of it or not, I'll let you know tomorrow. You know, we'll be following up on this.
Well, that'd be good to know. And I just have one more thing.
Sure.
Do we have any hope that the Democratic Party is going to try to bring some criminal charges against all of these insane dealings they've been pulling off and trying to pull off?
I'd say there's a very high probability of it. It's just that they have to get control of the House and Senate in order to do it. You can't have, see, whoever runs the House and Senate, whichever party runs it, determines whether or not a committee can hold a hearing and whether they have the power of the subpoena to compel testimony under oath. And
Right. Because
the Republicans control both the House and the Senate, and for all practical purposes have ever since Bush became president, they have blocked every attempt by Democrats to investigate anything. I mean, when Clinton was president, you had Republican control of the House and Senate. You had investigations of whether or not he should have fired his travel agent. They spent millions of dollars investigating whether he should have fired his travel agent. I don't know, maybe they thought he was having an affair with the other travel agent, right? I mean, what was the deal? Right? They were looking at everything. Clinton sneezes. Oh, gee, what is? Is he testing a new antibiotic on himself or something? Or has he been snorting cocaine? It was incredible. There was literally every single week, for the better part of 7 years, there was a new investigation into something that the Clintons were up to. There hasn't been one investigation since Bush came into office of the executive branch. Not one. That's wrong. That's just wrong. 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, 6 minutes past the hour. Jeffrey Feldman, one of the nation's leading experts in framing that dimension of neurolinguistic programming, defining the language. How do we define the perspective, the window through which we are viewing things, the color of the glasses, is with us. I'm broadcasting live from the Quake, KQKE in San Francisco, and Jeffrey is at the Air America Studios in New York City, and through the wonders of technology, it's going to sound like we're in the same room. Hey, Jeffrey.
Hey, Tom. How are you?
I'm just great. Great to have you here with us. Over at frameshopisopen.com, your website, your lead story, Rummy launches a new campaign. Tell us about this.
Yeah, Donald Rumsfeld this week at a Veterans of Foreign War event accused anybody who criticizes the Bush policy in Iraq of doing the same thing that the Europeans did in the 1930s, appeasing the fascists, as he calls it. And what's really interesting about this is what the Republicans are trying to do, once again, as we move into the kind of whitewater rapids of the election season, is convince the American public that if they support the Democrats, then the world's worst things will happen to them. The last time there were elections, we had Dick Cheney talking about atomic bombs going off in the middle of our cities. We had just recently Cheney talking about encouraging the terrorists to attack us again, and now Rumsfeld talking about appeasing Hitler.
Yeah, remember that line just before the election? We're going to be hit and hit hard if Kerry's elected.
Exactly.
And it was almost like, you know, he knew it would produce outrage, and therefore he knew it would get repeated over and over and over again, which is exactly what he wanted.
That's exactly what he wants. And he also wants to elicit what has become a knee-jerk response from what I think of as the old-school Democrats, which is when they hear the Republicans accusing us of being weak on defense, they really get very, very nervous. I'm talking about people with seniority in the Senate and in the Congress. They want to stand up and say, no, 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 Democrats are really strong on defense, which is a terrible way to go. What they need to do is recognize that what Rumsfeld is responding to is not some threat that's coming out of the Middle East, but it's the threat of being held accountable by the voters in November. There's nothing that makes the Republicans in office right now more afraid than the fact that Democrats are gaining ground in every campaign where they're leading with the message of holding the Republicans accountable. And so the way to reframe this particular incident is not to talk about being strong on defense, but to continue talking about Rumsfeld and Bush answering for what they have done in Iraq, facing the American people, listening to our voices. And that's the way to control this particular issue.
Attack the attacker.
Exactly. That's
this, this is the Karl Rove strategy. And although, frankly, I mean, you know, Karl Rove put some pretty sick twists on it and sick spins on it. And for the Democrats, it really should simply be, okay, he said that, let's take him on. You know, let's take this guy on.
Exactly. And we've got the facts right now behind us. And the one potential weakness is that Democrats will feel that they once again need to stand up and say that, no, 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 we're strong on defense. But the American public is seeing that the Republican policies have failed and failed miserably. People feel more afraid. They feel more threatened by these supposed dangers that the Republicans are stopping through their policies in Iraq and elsewhere. So it's really a matter of not giving in to that knee-jerk Democratic tendency to worry about being weak on defense and to really talk about accountability. But talk about it in basic, really simple phrases, to talk about making the president and his administration answer for what they've done, face up to the American people, and really control the frame that way.
I love the suggestions that you have. We're talking with Jeffrey Feldman. He's the editor-in-chief over at frameshopisopen.com. And I love these phrases. If I may, just pretend I'm a Democratic politician and toss some of them out here, Jeffrey Feldman.
Sure.
Okay. Rumsfeld is campaigning again. Rumsfeld is afraid Democrats are about to regain control of Congress. Rumsfeld is worried he will soon have to answer for what he has done. Nothing scares Rumsfeld more than the fear of facing the American people. Facing the prospect of answering to the American people, Rumsfeld will accuse us of more and more outlandish crimes. Come on, give us a break. Rumsfeld is lashing out like a cornered thief. That was brilliant. And the more he senses he might have to answer for his crimes, the more he will accuse his accusers. Yeah, I mean, I just wish we could, like, you know, do some sort of a Balkan mind meld with the Democratic politicians in this country and transplant these verbatim quotes into their brains.
Yeah, old habits are hard to break. And in the Senate in particular, you have a lot of Democrats who are convinced both by consultants that they've been working with for years and simply by what they feel now instinctively that at every opportunity when the Republicans attack them on defense, they need to respond within that same frame. When in fact, what the American public is sick of right now is a Republican administration that is not being held to account by any other branch of the government. And what the American public has the opportunity to do this fall is to transfer control of one or more of those branches of government to the Democratic Party and thereby hold them to account. That's what the public really is responding to, and that's what Democrats need to start saying.
And pointing out that that's what the Republicans are afraid of, and that's why they're bringing out these increasingly hysterical statements. I mean, had a Democrat come out and said things like Rumsfeld said yesterday, you would have one of two frames would have been trotted out, probably both at the same time, in all the right-wing talk shows, and frankly, all the major news media, which have become the echo chamber for the right-wing talk shows. It would have been either the Republicans are afraid and they're on the run, or the Republicans are shrill and angry.
Yeah, and it's just going to get worse. I mean,
the Democrats, excuse me.
Exactly, but it's going to get much worse. I mean, after this election, because there's the rising candidate in the Republicans is now Newt Gingrich, who seems to be polling on top of all the other pile of Republican candidates, and Gingrich.
He's reinvented himself.
He's reinvented himself, and he's pushing a really disturbing idea. He seems to want to run on this notion that unless you elect him, then America will be the losers of World War III. He's actually using that phrase, and so despite logic, the Republicans are going to kick up the heat more and more on this idea that there's these terrible, terrible dangers that are going to descend upon this country unless you vote for a Republican. So these frames, the idea of accountability, it's important this week and it's important for November, but Democrats really need to keep focused on this in order to fend off this scaremongering that's going to get louder and louder from the GOP.
Right, and when the Republicans use this particular frame to throw a message at the American people, rather than stepping into that frame and trying to fight it out, what the Democrats need to do is just shatter that frame and then put forward their own. Frameshopisopen.com, the website. We're talking with Jeffrey Feldman, the editor-in-chief, chief cook and bottle washer over there. And Jeffrey, you comment on frameshopisopen.com about spin and nothingness. This George Bush is returning to the scene of the crime.
It is amazing. A year ago, I wrote a piece on Frameshop that I called The Stranger, in which I commented about the fact that Bush seemed, in the wake of Hurricane Katrina, to be inexplicably detached emotionally from what was going on there. The entire country was literally pulling its hair out of its head, crying, looking at what was happening in New Orleans. And there was Bush, oblivious to the whole thing.
Oh, he was eating cake with John McCain and playing rock and roll with or country western with a music star.
Exactly. And even when they got him on the ground in New Orleans, he still seemed emotionally detached. And in looking at the coverage of the one-year anniversary of Katrina, what blew me away was the fact that Bush is still completely detached. And despite all that, he was pushing this message that he had learned the lessons of Hurricane Katrina. He had repeated that phrase over and over again. So I write about it in this piece, Spin and Nothingness, that, you know, we have a president that really is incapable of learning any lessons, that the lesson the American people have learned is that it's time to move on from a president that is incapable of getting anything new into his head.
Yeah, the lesson of Katrina is don't trust the Bush administration. Don't trust Republicans, basically, because they don't believe in government. So don't trust them to control a government, run a government, make a government work, because they don't believe in government. They're just going to figure out some way to take our tax dollars and give them to Blackwater and Halliburton and Bechtel.
Exactly. And one of the things that the public is starting to see is that what happened in New Orleans was really the grand achievement of a conservative vision of government that pulls away from caring about the people.
Yeah, actually, yeah, good point. And in fact, when Bush says, "I've learned the lessons of Katrina," he never says what those lessons are.
Exactly.
I thought that was particularly telling. Also over at frameshopisopen.com, George Allen with a wink. This is pretty amazing.
Yeah, I mean, the thing about framing is that it's not just about what people say, but it's also how they behave when they speak. And looking at a video of George Allen apologizing for his macaca comment, I noticed that
now,
he...
Let me, if I may preface this.
Sure.
He's speaking to an all-white audience.
An all-white audience of elderly people.
Right.
And a woman from the audience asked him a question about a word he used in another context, and he responded by saying, "Look, I want to be very careful about the words that I use." He paused, he winked and smiled at the audience, and everybody cracked up. A minute and a half later, he gave his staged, canned apology, and it was just startling to me how he seemed to be establishing a rapport with a wink and a smile to the room, with a room full of white folks, basically saying, "Look, you and I, we all know that this is just about politics, but we understand what's really going on here. This is about the PC Democrats trying to catch me, but we're not going to let them."
We all know that this is all about politics, or was it the all, you know, wink, nod, we're all just racists here?
Yeah, that's a good question.
Yeah. And that's a tough one. I suspect it's probably more of the latter. He's spent his whole entire career being proud of his racism.
Despicable.
Yep. Frameshopisopen.com, the website. Jeffrey Feldman, the editor-in-chief. Jeffrey, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
Always great talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman radio program, Truth and Common Sense for a Change.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
It's good to be king, have your own way, get a feeling of peace at the end of the day. And when your bulldog barks and your canary sings, you're out there with me. It's good to be king.
Yeah, spoken like a true member of the Bush family. Welcome back. It's 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. By the way, San Diego, you know, the Busby-Bill Ray race, I believe it's Congressional District 50 in California, the 50th Congressional District. They had a special election because Duke Cunningham got caught with his fingers in the cookie jar. He got caught taking bribes from defense contractors of all. How shocking! What, defense contractors have a little extra money they want to pass it? Well, in any case, he's off to jail, sobbing, and who wouldn't? And so they hold an election. And the voting machines go home for a sleepover, and Francine Busby campaigns on, you can't trust the machines, so do a... You know, send, you know, a variation on the old vote early, vote often, right? At least the vote early part of it. She's like, you know, get an absentee ballot and send it in. That was her campaign. I mean, that was the main call to action in Busby's campaign, was get an absentee ballot and send it in. And tens of thousands of her voters, or thousands, I don't know the exact number, but a really good-sized chunk of the electorate in that race, more than normal, voted by absentee ballot. And virtually all of them, you would think, since this was the focus of her campaign, were voting for Busby. Well, the initial count is done on the vote, and the absentee ballots have not yet been opened. So all the people who voted on paper by absentee ballot, so that there would definitely be a paper trail, their votes have not yet even been counted. And the assistant county clerk, like a number two person, says, well, it looks like Bill Ray's won the race. And based on this, it looks like Bill Ray has won the race, Denny Hastert says, great, let's swear him in. So they fly this guy out to Washington, D.C., this Republican from San Diego, and they swear him in before the election has even been certified. Based on the preliminary count, before the absentee ballots have even been counted, they swear this guy in. And so, you know, a number of folks sued them and said, hey, wait a minute, you can't do this. You can't swear somebody in until the election has at least been certified. This election wasn't even certified. Paul Lato, the lawyer from Snohomish County, Washington, that successfully got that county in Washington to be the only county in Washington state that no longer by law can use voting machines, electronic voting machines. And good on you, Paul. Paul Lato led the lawsuit. So Judge Uri Hoffman dismisses the case. Says, sorry, I don't have the right to rule on this because I'm just a state of California judge, and Bill Ray's already been sworn in by Denny Hastert at the federal level. He's now a member of Congress. Do you get this? A judge in San Diego, a state judge in San Diego, has ruled that if the Speaker of the House of Representatives decides to swear in a candidate before all the votes have been counted and before the election has been certified, that's it. The election's over. No need to count any farther. It's a done deal. This has got to be one of the biggest election stories since the Bush v. Gore decision by the Supreme Court, in which Justice Rehnquist, the former Republican official who was made famous when he was a political operative in Arizona in the 1950s, intimidating African Americans at the polling places. Yes, that's what Rehnquist was famous for. Showing up at polling places and intimidating African Americans, that he ruled that we the people, do not have, it is not in the Constitution, an inherent right to vote for President of the United States. And therefore, if Jeb Bush says, well, actually, if the legislature, if the House of Representatives and the Senate, might have been just the House of Representatives of the state of Florida, which is in Republican control, if they say that Bush won Florida, then Bush won Florida. It doesn't matter what the voters say. Now, actually, constitutionally, he was right, Rehnquist, because the Constitution does say that each state shall decide how the electoral votes will be sent to the Electoral College. But it doesn't say that about the House of Representatives. I'm not an attorney or constitutional scholar on this. We're going to try and get Harvey Wasserman, and maybe he can shed some light on what's going on with the destruction of ballots in Ohio, and maybe even some thoughts on the Busby-Bill Ray race. But it sure seems to me like this is the absolute, you know, nail in the coffin for our electoral system. Here we have a judge saying that if the Republican Speaker of the House decides to swear in a candidate before all the votes have been counted, then you can stop counting the votes because the guy's now a member of Congress. I guarantee you there's nothing in the Constitution that says that. But this judge says, hey, you know, he's a federal officer, I'm a state judge, I don't have jurisdiction. Bizarre. 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Looking for a leader to bring our country home. Reunite the red, white, and blue before it turns to stone. Looking for somebody dumb enough to take it on. Clean up the corruption and make the country strong.
There you go. Well said, Neil Young. Thank you very much. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. The place where smart people get their news. Beyond Macaca, the photograph that haunts George Allen. Max Blumenthal writing over at The Nation magazine, thenation.com. There's a link to it also from thinkprogress.org. George Allen, along with the successor organization to the White Citizens Council. The Council of Conservative Citizens is how they renamed themselves when it became politically impolitic in 1996, to call themselves the White Citizens Council. And there he is with a bunch of white citizens. Yes, indeed. In the Statement of Principles, the White Citizens Council, well, now called, excuse me, the Council of Conservative Citizens, with whom George Allen is photographed over at thenation.com, they declare in their Statement of Principles, quote, "We also oppose all efforts to mix the races of mankind, to promote non-white races over the European American through so-called affirmative action and similar measures, to destroy or denigrate the European American heritage, including the heritage of the Southern people, and to force the integration of the races," end quote. Yeah. Bob Barr of Georgia and Trent Lott of Mississippi have also been guests of these folks. And arguably embrace that philosophy. It's interesting. It's kind of sick. You know, sometimes you learn stuff. I learned something about the bridge to nowhere. I think. I'm assuming that this is just a straight up, you know, several of our Alaskan listeners have sent me notes sent me notes in the last hour or so. And this one from Bruce is particularly well-spoken. And I find it's interesting. I guess occasionally bad people do good things. He says, when you started your discussion about who had put on hold the budget search program, I guessed that it was Ted Stevens. He's a vile person, no doubt about it. That said, and it makes me really sick to speak in his defense, the bridge to nowhere is actually a pretty good idea. The island has very few people living on it, but it is, I believe, the home of Ketchikan International Airport. While not huge as compared to Chicago, Atlanta, or Dallas, it's a pretty big commercial airport for the state of Alaska, and it's a true pain in the butt to have to catch the ferry to get to the airport. They had a 727 crash there back in 1976, if memory serves, and may have had another with a large loss of life due to the inability to get necessary people to the site. And, well, it could make Stevens Bridge to Nowhere look pretty good and bite those that killed the bridge right in the butt. So he says, Stevens bad. However, it's not completely true that the Bridge to Nowhere is bad. Ketchikan really does need a bridge to their international airport. That's interesting. Now, another Alaska listener. And by the way, let me encourage you folks to give us a call. It's a whole lot easier because usually I don't read my email while I'm on the air. I just happen to be doing it right now. I'm broadcasting from a different studio than I usually operate out of, so I'm using a different computer. Paul writes in, he says, my brother lives in Ketchikan where the bridge to nowhere was to be built. The island where the bridge to be built to is where their airport is and is now served by a ferry. The main cost is because it has to be high enough so that the cruise ships larger than the Titanic can get under it. The people pushing for the bridge, he says, put my brother on the list, even though he's lower middle class and rents his apartment, are the rich developers because it'll double the land value on the island. So I guess we have a whole bunch of different competing interests. But anyhow, all this was brought about because of the discussion of, you know, asking the question, who is it who put the hold on the piece of Senate legislation that passed unanimously out of committee? Democrats and Republicans equally in favor of it. Who is it who put the hold on this legislation saying, no, the American people don't have the right to see how their federal dollars are being spent. Over $2 trillion last year. Wouldn't it be nice to be able to Google search it? Or the equivalent of it. You know, build a government database and a search engine that allows you to search, you know, where's your money, your government money going? And Ted Stevens, apparently the guy who put the hold on it. And it may well be that he did it, not because he doesn't think it's a good idea, but because he's trying to burn Tom Coburn, a fellow Republican, who voted against the Bridge to Nowhere, which is, in fact, the bridge to Ketchikan, international airport, apparently. And I guess I'll just have to leave it at that for the moment. Maybe we'll get back to that in a little bit. 1-866-440-THOM, our telephone number, 1-866-440-8466. And Armin in Florida on the line. Hey, Armin, welcome to the program.
I'm so thankful I can talk to you today.
Why is that?
Okay, I'm in Bradenton, and I always say I'm either Bradenton or Sarasota because I used to live in Sarasota, but I don't live there any longer, but it's like real close together here.
Yeah, I understand.
Okay, Sarasota is the home of the great Catherine Harris.
Oh, really? I didn't realize that. You know, I guess I can empathize with you. When I lived in Georgia, I lived in Newt Gingrich's district. So here we are, Armin, you and me.
Yeah, right. Secure thought ended. But
yeah,
anyway.
Yeah. So anyway.
So Sarasota, this is amazing. We moved back 20 years ago, and I've watched all these people come and go in politics and the whole spiel.
Yeah.
Well, basically, there's a public hospital, and it's called Sarasota Memorial. And I could write a book about that and the private hospital that Bill Frist's family owns, too, but maybe I'll do that later. But anyway, they had a big thing in today's paper. They said, oh, the people that have crappy insurance or no insurance at all cost the public hospital $30 million last year.
Mm-hmm.
So they have Tom, they have some super high-priced administrators and presidents of that corporation. First, I want to say that.
Well, you got to make money and you got to pay your CEOs because that's the Republican way.
Well, see, this, like I said, this community, Sarasota, you know, prides herself on being Republican. So anyway, so what's their solution going to be? The same thing that it's been the last, ever since the Clintons tried to get national health care. The solution is they're going to lay off people, and they're going to raise the room cost. And when my insurance already told me, when I used to have it before they shafted me, they said, you know, we'll pay $500 a night, but in Sarasota, it's like it was like $1,500 or $2,000 a night for a crappy room. And my point is, we need national health care, but I totally agree with you. We're not going to get out of this mess in this country, Tom. We're just not going to get out of it as long as everybody's getting payoffs,
yeah,
whether it's Democrats or Republicans.
Yeah, no, the system is fundamentally broken, Armin. You're right.
Right. My wife says, well, there's why we need national health care. And we had an argument about it. And I says, why would you throw money at a system that has systemic problems from the top? I says, where's the incentive going to be to change the system that rewards cronyism, fraternal orders, and secret institutions and groups and stuff that run all these things? What is incentive going to be for them to change their ways when human nature is so strong the way it is and eliminate their jobs and their overpriced occupations that they're
Well, the incentive paid? Has to be when we throw the bums out of office. I mean, that's the ultimate term limits, the ultimate response to this kind of thing is the ballot box, Armin. And I realize that there's problems with it. I'm the first one to point them out. But nonetheless, we need to be showing up and we need to be getting politically active. We need to be speaking out.
Well, I agree with you, but the force that we're up against, and you know it and I know it, and we have to be honest with ourselves. The first thing you have to deal with, like they tell drunks, you know, they got to crash all the way to the bottom and deal with reality. They got to go all the way to the bottom. I hope that doesn't have to be the case with our society and our government and our economy. But my point is that the media is so strong, it's so powerful, it's so corrupted, and the CEOs of the media are all together with the CEOs of all these corrupt corporations that reward themselves and immune themselves and put up barriers that pay off attorneys, legislators, all kinds of people to make law to protect their veil of unbridled theft, greed, and it's such a hard thing. I don't know what we're going to do because the only way that we're going to change it is to put people in that really want to serve the interests of this country for the sake of serving the interest. And to get those kind of people and not have them demonized by this corrupt, filthy media. And I'm sorry I use that strong language. I know you're so cultured, and I'm trying to learn so much from you.
Well, I'm part of the media, Armin.
No, but you're the good. Listen to me. You know.
I understand exactly what you're saying, and I think we just need to be speaking out. We need to be calling it what it is. We need to be saying it. And you're a truth teller, Armin, and I appreciate it. You know you get out there and you speak about it, and you're agitating with your friends, and you're politically active. I know that, and you call in this program regularly, and I appreciate all of it. I want to thank you for that. Gary in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Gary, what's on your mind today?
Here's another loyal truth teller.
Yeah, there you go.
Okay, can we have a short conversation here?
It's going to have to be short. We have 30 seconds.
Oh, God. All right, I'm just going to give the quote. I'm just going to give something, and I'll get back to you on discretionary time. I think you got to have a show on it or interview somebody. The quote is by Alexis de Tocqueville. Did you ever hear of
Alexis de Tocqueville, yeah. He wrote Democracy in America in 1836.
I'll have to give that. What is most, and this dovetails right into it, what is most important for democracy is not that great fortune should not exist, but that great fortune should not remain in the same hands.
Yeah.
In that way, they do not form a class.
You're right. And that was what Thomas Paine was talking about in The Rights of Man when he proposed essentially an inheritance tax. It's what Jefferson talked about when he proposed an inheritance tax. Solid, spot on, Gary. Well said. Thank you very much. 45 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
3 chicks came from Texas with a banjo and guitar and a fiddle that could make you cry or set your soul on fire. Their mamas taught them to speak up about what they thought was true, and they thought their country gave that right to them and me and you. Now one night back in England, one of these babes brought up a beef about how she wasn't to be witched with her commander-in-chief. Some folks did not appreciate how she denounced their man. These patriots rolled up their sleeves and took matters in hand.
Let's meet all the Dixie chicks. We're too nice to use rocks and sticks. So let's demolish their CDs with a bulldozer or whatever you please.
If this reminds you a little bit of bonfires in Berlin, well, cowboy, that just goes to prove it can always happen again.
And welcome back. 9 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. David Sirota blogging about Joe Lieberman's new ad. I've got to tell you about this thing. This is just absolutely incredible. What it's what he's doing in Connecticut. And I realize, you know, this program is heard all over the United States, and there's people tuning in all over the world, and it's not a Connecticut program, or not just a Connecticut program. But what Joe Lieberman, or I should say, and what Joe Lieberman is doing in Connecticut is essentially the DLC strategy, the moderate Democrat, which is really the Republican Democrat, Democratic strategy, a strategy among those Democratic candidates who are beholden to corporate interests, really is what it boils down to. I mean, Joe Lieberman, all about NAFTA and China, PNTR, and just rubber stamping Bush appointees like Brownie. And, well, let me tell you about it in just a minute. First, Alan in Seattle, Washington. Alan's been waiting to get on the... Hey, Alan, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks, Tom. I appreciate you and all the work that you do to bring out issues that are very important to the American population and public.
Well, thank
and
you.
The world.
Yeah.
Anyway, talking about the Alaskan senator, which really got me started about this, it's something I've been thinking about for a long time, regarding war profiteering. And a quote by FDR is, "I do not want to see a single war millionaire created in the U.S. as a result of this war disaster." That was during World War II.
Yeah, he said that, in fact, in response to Harry Truman starting an investigation into war profiteering.
Right, so Truman likened any form of war profiteering as treason.
Yep.
And I think treason is really something that we as a population of progressive thinking people should actually be focusing on. Because I think in your program and other programs on Air America, it's really become very clear that the good Americans, the Republicans as they call themselves, are really not Americans. And they are actually the antithesis of what America is. I mean, growing up as a kid, I always believed liberty and justice for all meant for all people in the world, not just the United States. You know, now I have a sign on my car that says liberty and justice for few. But what I'm proposing to someone like you who has a nationwide audience is to actually, you know, we talk about Halliburton and we talk about, you know, Boeing. I mean, it's a perfect example. Here I live in Seattle and I call anybody who works for the War Division of Boeing as complicit war criminals. And it's a very difficult position to be in because they're very nice people, my neighbors.
Yeah, you know, and it's a very difficult one to push, too. I remember when I was living in Atlanta, and one of the guy who went on to become the president of IBM, I'm forgetting his name right now, but he was the head of RJR, and he had just testified before Congress that nicotine was not addictive.
Right.
And I just went nuts. You know, I was not on the air at the time. I picked up the phone and I called RJR's headquarters, which was right there in the same town I was. And, you know, the person answering the phone, just very, you know, nice, friendly woman, hello, RJR. And I was like, how can you sleep at night working for a company that's killing 500,000 people a year?
Right. Well,
and her response was, you know, this is a job. I've got two kids in school and
exactly.
I've got to put them through school. And it hit me. I'm a human being talking to a human
exactly.
being. And we're all like stuck in this giant machine.
Well,
in some ways, I'm an enabler of it as much as anybody else. I mean, simply because we're here. We're using it. We're not, you know,
we're in the system. I mean,
yeah.
I totally agree. But I mean, we also have to be conscious about what we do.
Yeah.
And to be conscious of what we do, I mean, my thought was, you know, you have a lot of people listening, and some of them are highly qualified people, attorneys, constitutional lawyers. And the bottom line is, it should be our responsibility to identify who the criminals are. Because at some point, maybe, I mean, let me just get back to my original point, though. The bottom line is, how much longer can we go on saying what they've done today, 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 and today? And the fact is, we have so much evidence of the crimes against humanity, the crimes against our nation and the world that these criminals have done. And I think it's about time that we as American people actually take responsibility.
Yeah,
and actually,
I agree with you, Alan.
Thanks very much for your time, Tom.
Sure, you're welcome, and thanks for the call. Here's the bottom line. The Republican Party has, in many ways, and I say this again, you know, like calling up this poor woman at RJR and hassling her when really it wasn't her, it was the guys up in the executive offices. But there are some good Republicans out there. I mean, you know, my parents, my father's deceased now, but both of my parents, he went to his grave a Republican. He believed that someday the party could come back to the ideals of Dwight Eisenhower. So acknowledging that there are some good Republicans out there, nonetheless, I think that it is accurate to say that the Republican Party of today, by and large, has become an enterprise of organized crime. They are, and it may be that many of the things that they're doing are not actually breaking laws because they have the power to make the laws so they can modify the laws so that what would have been 30 years ago or 50 years ago or 100 years ago, major crimes and felonies, you know, bribery and just scandalous behavior is now technically legal. But nonetheless, the Republican Party has become the party of organized crime. And there is a faction within the Democratic Party that wants to do the same thing. Lieberman is part of it, and his whole DLC bunch. And, at a certain point, the American people have to say, yeah, okay, we get it. And we don't want the mob running the country. Thank you very much. And we're going to throw these guys, we're going to throw these bums out. And it just gets right down to that, ultimately. And that's why we need to be politically active. 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. For a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back to our program. 6 minutes past the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Our program brought to you in part by Sacred Grounds Coffee, the organic coffee roasters. It's some just absolutely incredible coffee these folks have. You can give him a call at 1-800-425-2532 any day from 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, or visit their website at sacredgroundscoffee.com. Pretty straightforward. Anyhow, welcome back to the program. Can you imagine if, let's say, Iran was to give, let's say, you $80 million to figure out a way to overthrow George W. Bush, to overthrow the Bush administration, to overthrow, in fact, beyond that, to overthrow the entire Republican Party, and have a proxy party, let's say Hezbollah, in the United States, take control of the United States. How do you think, if you received $80 million from Iran to help Hezbollah overthrow the United States and let's say, infiltrate the Democratic Party and or even infiltrate the Republican Party and overthrow George W., how do you think that would fly with the, say, Department of Homeland Security? How do you think that would fly with the media? How do you think the average person would deal with that? Well, we're learning now that essentially the United States is doing that exact same thing down in Venezuela. $80 million, more or less, nobody's sure exactly about the amount, has been given, well, this the article in The Guardian today, the British newspaper, headline, U.S. accused of bid to oust Chavez with secret funds. Millions of dollars given to opposition critics claim Venezuelan groups details hidden from list. Duncan Campbell writes, the U.S. government has been accused of trying to undermine the Chavez government in Venezuela by funding anonymous groups via its main international aid agency. This is coming through U.S. the Agency for International Development, USAID. They have an office called the Office of Transition Initiatives. We're going to promote an initiative to create the transition from one leader in a nearby country or another country to another leader. The row follows the recent announcement that the U.S. had made $80 million available for groups seeking to bring about change in Cuba, whose leader Fidel Castro is a close ally of Mr. Chavez. So, as I said, they're not sure how much money has been spent in Venezuela. Looks like it might be a similar amount. Now, I can understand the United States government taking a position on another government. I can understand the Voice of America broadcast. I mean, all this stuff is done out in the open. But when you're giving money secretly to groups who operate in secret, whose goal is to bring down another government, something about that just doesn't seem to me consistent with the idea of democracy. Particularly if you're arguing that the reason why you're doing it is to bring about democracy. What am I missing from this picture? You know, every country has foreign policies that are designed to help friends and punish enemies. I mean, there's no doubt about that. But to be funding basically insurgencies within, I mean, this goes back to the Reagan era. You know, we did this in Central America, and look what it led to. It led to death squads. Well, Death Squad John Negroponte goes down to Central America. And the next thing you know, we're finding bodies with people shot through the head, their hands handcuffed behind their backs, and signs of torture. Americans didn't really even pay that much attention to it, frankly, until some nuns got in the crossfire. Some American nuns. And then we send Death Squad John over to Iraq. Remember that, about a year ago? Make him the ambassador to Iraq for a little while, and all of a sudden, death squads show up in Iraq. The Salvadorization of Iraq? Well, I think that the American citizens, I think we the people are owed an answer. How is our money being used in Venezuela and in other countries around the world. I mean, even if you take a country that we all agree is being run by a vicious, tyrannical regime, let's say, for example, you know, Saudi Arabia. Actually, probably an example where you'd have a broader consensus would be Somalia. Okay, you got the Somali government that is using the Jinjaweed, these Muslim death squads, to go into Christian areas and just kill people, terrorize people, burn villages, rape the women to try and destroy the ethnic identity. You know, now they're going to have children who are part Muslim or, you know, et cetera. I mean, this is not a new strategy. They were doing it in Europe 1,000 years ago. But even there, it seems to me that if we're going to try to take down a government, or if we're going to try to change a government, that we should be doing it up front, out in the open. I think, frankly, we'd be much more effective doing it that way. Because when you start playing in the background, you know, and you start funding these, I mean, you just never know how that's going to end up biting you in the butt. I mean, that's how we brought the Shah to power. That's how we brought Saddam Hussein to power. That's how we brought a number of dictators around the world to power, and eventually it comes back to haunt us. People say, oh, you're just being naive, Hartman. This isn't a transparent world. You can't operate with transparency. No, I'm not being naive. You look at the times that we have succeeded. I mean, here's your example. Ronald Reagan, for all the conservatives out there listening. Reagan's negotiating with Gorbachev, and he comes right up front, and says, hey, you know, Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall. We don't like the way the Soviet Union is run. We don't think it's a good idea. It's wrong. Do something about it. Change it. You're not serving your people. And, you know, he was right. And his timing was perfect. I mean, the CIA had been predicting for about 20 years, and all the way back to the 70s, all the way back to the 60s, actually, that the Soviet Union was imploding from within, that it was crumbling from within, that they had an economic and political system that was unsustainable in its present form, and that it would collapse sometime in the 1980s. And so Reagan and his advisors, a good bet. Make some noise, and then when it falls, take credit for it. Actually, it fell after Reagan was gone. Bush Sr. was president. I think that's probably the greatest irony, is that Bush Sr. was president when the Berlin Wall fell, and everybody gives Reagan credit for it. I mean, poor Bush Sr., he gets no respect from anybody. But in any case, I mean, do it up front. Look at this. We tried to bring down the Russians in Afghanistan. How did we do it? We gave this guy named Osama bin Laden a whole pile of money and funded the Mujahideen. Good idea? Well, in retrospect, no. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Cody in San Francisco, California, the city from which I am broadcasting at this very moment. Hey, Cody, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. I work for PowersOfMorrison.com, and I wanted to shed some light on a issue we're having with an independent journalist, Josh Wolf. He's found himself in a very similar predicament as Judith Miller. He's in jail right now because he refuses to divulge his sources to George Bush's his executive branch's grand jury that's out harassing journalists. And the reason he's being investigated is because he was covering a protest, an anti-G8 summit in 2005, where allegedly someone threw a firecracker at an SFPD city police vehicle. And there's no federal authority for that. Even the city supervisors have voted unanimously condemning this action. And I cover this and my column, and also joshwolf.net has all of the raw data for people to go through to watch the videos.
Josh Wolf, is it Wolf with an E or without?
Without an E.
Joshwolf.net, okay.
Have you heard about this?
I have. I don't know the details, though. I admit to some passing, you know, I've heard about it, but I haven't drilled down into it.
Yeah, I mean, the federal intervention into what should be a city matter is, you know, beyond comprehension. I can't believe that, you know, they've got journalists in jail and they didn't do anything wrong and there's no media outcry.
Well, it's like the same thing that I was just talking about. Bush is like, you know, we'll tinker with Venezuela, we'll tinker with San Francisco. I mean, what happened to states' rights? What happened to independent nations? What happened to sovereignty? What happened to transparency? It's all gone. I mean, these guys are fascists.
Absolutely.
Cody, the website once again
is joshwolf.net and powersandmorrison.com.
Great. Powers and Morrison, M-O-R-R-I-S-O-N?
That's it.
Great.com. Cody, thanks a lot for the call and for the heads up. I appreciate it. I'll look into it. It's 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. 866-440-8466. We'll be right back.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Well, it's a strange old game, learn it slow. One step forward and it's back to go. You're standing on the throttle, standing on the brake. In the groove till you make a mistake. Sometimes you're the windshield, sometimes you're the bug. Sometimes it all comes together, but sometimes you're a fool in love.
Welcome back, 21 minutes past the hour. Sometimes you're the windshield, sometimes you're the bug, George. Welcome back to the program. Tom Hartman here with you. Larry Scott, member of the Disabled American Veterans, the Veterans of Foreign Wars, the American Radio Relay League, and chief cook and bottle washer over at VAWatchdog.org.
That's me.
That's you. Larry Scott, welcome to the program.
Well, good to be with you again, Tom. You're back in my old stomping grounds, born and raised in the Bay Area in Berkeley.
Oh, really?
Yes, sir.
I was here for a director's cut premiere of a movie that I'm in last night, Crude Impact, and it's not in release yet, and... So just, you know, doing the show here from the Clear Channel station, and Air America station in San Francisco. Having a great time.
Oh, good. Well, I've got a whole list of restaurants you should hit. Well, maybe we can do that later.
All right. Well, I'm heading home this afternoon. So, looking at VAWatchdog.org, you got some incredible stories here. I'd like to start, if you don't mind, with Max Cleland.
Max Cleland, former senator, former chief of the VA. This was before the VA was a secretariat level, was cabinet level position. They called him the VA chief back then. Vietnam veteran,
lost both legs and
both
his right arm.
And one arm in Vietnam. According to Ann Coulter, he picked up a grenade on purpose, but we won't go there. Which is a very sad story. The man was wounded in action and a true war hero. And Max Cleland has come out and admitted that he is having some real problems with post-traumatic stress disorder, and he has checked in and is receiving treatment now for PTSD. What is interesting about this is it was Cleland's pressure on the Veterans Administration many years ago that actually forced them to start the very heavy-duty mental health counseling programs for Vietnam veterans, and also the PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, programs for Vietnam veterans. And now Senator Cleland is taking advantage of the programs that he helped institute so many years ago.
Yeah. Now, one of the things that I thought was most interesting about this is that Max Cleland is saying, apparently, that, and you can confirm this for me if you're more familiar with the story than I, that the thing that has triggered his post-traumatic stress disorder, that he's lived apparently without it for many, many years, and what's brought it back is watching the scenes on television of the ongoing violence in Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
And if that's doing it to him, there's another half a million. There's got to be what? How many vets are there? How many combat vets are there in the United States? If you look
quite
at all
a few,
the
quite a few million. I don't have an exact number on that.
So there have to be several million Americans
who are
a few veterans of World War II, veterans of the Korean conflict, veterans of the Vietnam War, veterans of the various wars, little short wars that Reagan got us into, the Afghan campaign, the Iraq campaign, the first Iraq War, and so on, who are probably in the same boat as Max Cleland. All of a sudden, they're now struggling.
And basically what Cleland has been saying is that for many, many years, he's been able to tune it out. He's been able to control it, and he's been able to keep it at a level where it hasn't interfered with his life. And suddenly, the ongoing media reports, the graphic nature now of many of the media reports, because as you've seen, television coverage has become more and more graphic in the last year or so.
Although it's still nothing compared to what you see on Al Jazeera.
No, it's nothing.
What they're seeing in the Arab world of their own people being blown up is
absolutely is nothing at all.
Now, at the same time, let me juxtapose these two stories. So here we have Max Cleland being sort of the I lack a word, the metaphor for, I suppose, all the vets in the United States, at least all the combat vets in the United States. At the same time, Dr. Sally Satel is saying that the biggest threat to something, you'll have to tell me what is the threat. She says a lingering threat are clinicians, not the vets, not the wars, not the insane politicians who send our young men and women off to fight and die in these wars, but it is the clinicians, the physicians, the doctors and nurses who are, she says, too quick to reach for the permanent disability claims form for post-traumatic stress disorder.
Dr. Sally Satel is a paid mouthpiece. She's a hack. She's a writer for hire for the American Enterprise Institute, the AEI, ultra-conservative. She writes what she's told to write, and the AEI the last couple of years has really gone after veterans with PTSD, Tom, saying that they talk about the number of so-called fakers, although they've never been able to prove numbers, and now they've taken a slightly different approach, and Sally Satel is their paid gun for hire. And what she's basically saying is that in the past, we were too quick to diagnose, and what we shouldn't really do is diagnose. What we should do is help these people find jobs. It's really kind of simple. Well, let's not give them compensation. Let's not tell them they're sick. Let's tell them that they can recover and they can go out and they can find work and they can be a normal person. I think the real truth is halfway in between. And of course, what Sally Satel doesn't tell you, she talks about the PTSD programs of the past. She doesn't tell you about today, where they do work to reintegrate veterans.
Yeah, it's tragic. It's really tragic. That, and there's a whole bunch of other news here that is really worth checking out, particularly if you're a veteran or know a veteran. Go to vawatchdog.org and you can read all about it. Larry Scott, thanks for being with us today.
Tom, it's great.
Good talking with you. 27 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman program.
I lost my bus now, do you know where did my ballot go? Lost my faith in the government when they changed the rules without my consent. Don't wanna be nobody's experiment. Just wanna know where my ballot went. They lost my
ballot. I'd like to know. Even worse than losing your ballot is what just happened in San Diego, where a California state judge, just came right out and said, it doesn't matter what the voters said. I mean, he didn't use those words, but the effect was the same. Denny Hastert has sworn Mr. Bill Ray in as the congressman from the 50th district, and therefore, even though all the votes haven't been counted, even though the election hadn't been certified, he doesn't have any jurisdiction. A state judge doesn't have any jurisdiction. He says, I can't. You know, the feds, Denny Hastert, well, they've already done this. It's a done deal. What can I do? And he may be right, which is the scariest part of the whole thing. That Dennis Hastert can simply come in and say, you know, we're going to swear this guy in. We're going to swear him in right now, even though the provisional ballots have not been counted yet. Even though his opponent's main campaign platform, or not platform, but call for action, was vote on a provisional ballot so you'll have a paper trail. Well, we haven't counted those yet, but it looks like he won, so we'll just swear him in. No, the election hasn't been certified, and now the state court says, no, we can't do anything about it, sorry. We've covered a lot of territory here so far in the last 2.5 hours. Looks like I'm going to be filling in for Randy Rhodes this afternoon, by the way, so there'll be another 4 hours to go, and a lot more material, no doubt. But Ted Stevens, is he Alaska's number one pork barrel guy? Who really ended the Cold War? What can we do? How can we get politically active? A lot of stuff on the agenda here. And what should we be doing? In fact, let's just start out with Ann in Eugene, Oregon. Hey, Ann.
Yeah, hi. I'd like to end this debate about who ended the Cold War. It was definitely Gorbachev, because it was going to be that person anyway. The ball was always in the Soviet court.
Yeah. In fact, I would go beyond that. I would say it wasn't even Gorbachev who ended the Cold War. It was the laws of economics and politics. It's almost a law of nature. The 60s, the CIA was, excuse me, back in the 60s, mm-hmm. It was the CIA saying the Soviet Union has a 20-year lifespan.
Yeah, but I heard that when I was 12 years old, that, the economics were bad. In dictatorships, they can have very bad economics, but they don't give up power.
Yeah.
So that
well, that's a good point. It was Gorbachev who had the moral rectitude or the moral courage to say, okay, this is not the right thing. You're right.
And it was a victory for America. Well, not a victory. It was a nonpartisan accomplishment. You know, Reagan was the Cold Warrior. He stood in one place. It was important that Gorbachev do it with not what was considered the opposition party at the time, but with what was considered the main party at the time, which was led by this Cold Warrior. So that was important to the point where I was writing him and telling him that, because he was thinking about...
You were writing who?
Waiting until the next election.
You were writing to who about what?
Gorbachev. I think it was my first political letter.
Yeah, to Gorbachev.
And,
interesting.
But, and he was considered a miracle by George Kennan, but he was somebody who genuinely believed in spirit, in freedom and stuff like that. And Reagan stood in one place. You knew he could not be compromised there in that respect.
Yeah.
So, but it was an American accomplishment. It was not a partisan victory. As a matter of fact, the people who came into power right after that, I still remember a Newsweek article or a Time article, a reporter interviewed somebody from the Pentagon saying, now that the Cold War is over, what is your mission? You don't have an enemy. And this fellow, who didn't have a name apparently, was unnamed in the article, said, well, we're looking at some of the data, and we think Iraq might be troublesome in the future. So they selected Iraq as a scapegoat
to be
the next enemy.
What a surprise. Anne, thanks a lot for the call and
thank you.
Keeping the record straight. Sharon in Camino Island, Washington. Hey, Sharon.
Hi, Tom. How are you doing?
I'm great. How are you today?
Good. You're in my favorite place. Anyway, by the way, they only get in California about $18 per person pork barrel, but in Alaska, last book I'm looking at here in 2004, they got $808 a person. On why Ted Stevens doesn't want us to see where our federal dollars go.
Yeah.
I get the Congressional Pig Book summary, from Citizens Against Government Waste.
Yep.
And almost every year, Alaska is number one. Sometimes they're number two with Hawaii. But, it's no coincidence, of course, that Ted, old boy, is the chairman of the Appropriations Committee.
Mm-hmm.
And, that year, the 2004, they got from this pig book, the Taxpayers Get Scrooged Award, for a $2.2 million in pork for North Pole, Alaska, population 1,570. I've been there. There's nothing there. I traveled to Alaska in business for 15 years, and they really are a welfare state. Most of the employment is government or military, and most Alaskans count very, very much on their pipeline slush fund to live on. And they get thousands of dollars every year per man, woman, and child.
I can't speak directly to that. I've been in Alaska only very briefly and passing through. But let me make a point here, Sharon, that I think is, and I'd be curious to hear from our Alaskan listeners as well on this. In my opinion, there is a dynamic. There is a dynamic tension that's actually very important to democracy, that we want to elect people who represent us and our interests to Congress.
Right.
And so if my member of Congress, for example, I'm represented by Darlene Hooley, who's a Democrat out of Portland, Oregon. If Darlene Hooley goes to Congress and she gets money for my district and it helps out my quality of life, if she can improve a park in the area where I'm living and she can do that with federal funds, for example, and it's the park across the street from where I live,
right,
I'm happy camper.
Right.
And now you living up in Seattle or on Camino Island may look at that and say, hey, that's pork barrel money. So here's the tension. The tension is between the reasonable and appropriate instinct of people to vote for the representative who's going to bring home the bacon,
right,
and the desire of the other 534 members of the House and Senate combined who are trying to prevent that member from bringing home the bacon. And where it gets corrupt is when bringing home the bacon becomes the thing that people do using techniques that are inappropriate, that short circuit, that the normal tension and dynamic. And that's what Ted Stevens is trying to do by not giving us access to the information.
Right. And there's a balance. You know, Oregon that year only got $13 per person pork. We got 40 in Washington, but $808. I mean, there's no balance there for Alaska.
Yeah, it's a little off.
A little off. But I mean, so obviously he's controlling things and he doesn't want us to see what he's doing. And,
yeah.
And that's why he doesn't want you to easily go online and see where the federal dollars are going.
Not to mention the fact that he's still very, very PO'd at Tom Coburn.
Right, and he's very He's very PO'd at Maria Cantwell for fighting Anwar. And, you know, they want the Anwar oil money. It's money to them. It's nothing to do with oil for us. Nothing. And
it's profits for his buddies in the oil.
Yeah, he's come down here all the time campaigning against her.
Amazing.
He's a, you know, vindictive little. I heard him say that he was going to quit if we didn't let him have his bridge to nowhere.
I know. We should have let him quit.
Yeah, why didn't he quit? Why is he still there? Take him up on that.
Ted, keep your word, please. Okay, Sharon, thanks a lot
for
the call.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Dan in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Dan, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, have you checked out actblue.com?
Yeah, I have. You're talking about, my recollection is actblue.com is a website where you can, in fact, I think Nancy Skinner, an old friend of mine and radio talk show host who's running for Congress, that if you want to donate money to her campaign, you have to do it through ActBlue. I may be wrong, isn't that what that site is?
Well, really quick, I'll tell you, I was reading horsesass.org, which is one of the political blogs here in Washington,
uh-huh,
and the guy that's running it set up an ActBlue page for his favorite candidates two
right.
days ago.
Yep.
They've raised $5,000 for Darcy Berner and Peter Goldmark over in Spokane who really need funds.
That's
and
great.
I went in there and gave them some of my own money, just type in a credit card and donate to them. And then I realized, gosh, I could set up my own fundraising page, put my favorite candidates on there, and ask all my friends to donate and help me.
Yes, and I've seen people do that, and I think it's just a marvelous thing. It's a website that allows you to route campaign contributions to people who are running for political office with whom you agree. And, you know, yeah.
And the best thing is you can set up your own page and get your friends to help you, and you know, you feel good about being able to help out your cause and the candidates that you like.
Yeah, marvelous thing. Dan, thanks for the heads up on it.
Okay, Tom.
Good to hear from you. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Will in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Will, what's got you grumbling today?
Oh, the curmudgeon here.
Yeah.
Was that Tom Corbett? Is that his name? The Vietnam veteran who was who lost an arm and he was
No, that's Max Cleland.
Oh.
Tom Coburn is the Republican from Oklahoma who's in a spitting war with Ted Stevens.
You know, when I always get him mixed up with that other guy that worked for Clinton, Cleland.
Max Cleland, you know, campaigned for Bill Clinton. He was a Democrat. He was the head of Senate Armed Services Committee. He's a Vietnam vet.
Okay, I have the wrong guy.
Yeah. Okay. All righty. Well, sorry about that, Will. It's what can you say? It's a good try. But you know, we'll get the right guys as time goes. It's 45 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. Our number 866-440-8466. Place where our talking points come from: Jefferson and Madison, not some right wing think tank. I want to get into just very briefly why JonBenet now, right after this, 45 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Open up the dirty window, let the sun illuminate the Wi-Fi. You cannot find reaching for something in the distance. So close you can almost taste it. Release your inhibitions, feel the rain on your skin. No one else can feel it for you, only you can
Welcome back, my friends. 10 minutes before the hour. Well, coming up on 9 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. The Tom Hartman Radio Program, syndicated by Air America Radio. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. And is it Jude in Seattle on the line?
Hey, good morning, Tom.
Hi, Jude. What's up?
Well, I did a follow-up on the King County elections that you helped out with last week, and I wanted to let you know and the listeners that they had a great response.
Oh, that's marvelous.
Yeah,
marvelous.
It's very, very much. And then I'll be very succinct. The second one is C-SPAN did a piece yesterday on the groups that are going to be organizing in Washington, D.C., and it's headed by campdemocracy.org, and they are really focusing in on the constitutional crisis. And one, and there's a myriad of groups, you know, Democracy Rising, Focus on Democracy.
Yep.
But on September 19th, they're going to be there from the 5th of September to the 21st.
Yeah.
September 19th, I thought you might enjoy hearing, it's going to be Bush National Crime Day.
Oh, interesting. That's great.
They're going to do a march throughout Washington. They're going to go to Congress and the House.
Mm-hmm.
And then on October 5th, through the worldcan'twait.org,
right,
they're calling for a day of resistance where people,
yeah,
you know, that we get out,
yeah,
and that we don't work.
I've recorded a spot for these folks. You know, David Swanson helped put this thing together. He's an old friend. And
oh, he's a wonderful man.
Yeah, he's a great guy. And I've so wanted to go. And in fact, but I have this new book out, you know, this Screwed, the
middle class.
War against the middle class. Yeah. And so on Thursday and Friday, which I believe is September 7th and 8th, I don't have a calendar in front of me, but it's close to that. In any case, that weekend, that Thursday and Friday, next Thursday and Friday, Peter B. Collins is going to be filling in for me from the event in Washington, D.C.
Wonderful.
So
wonderful. So
I won't be able to be there. I'll be in New York doing a book signing and, you know, in media and stuff like that, doing the whole song and dance that you have to do when you have a book come out. But Peter will be doing that, and so this program will be there, and I'll be there in spirit, and maybe I'll call in.
Because you don't know what a tremendous mentor you are to the country and to the world.
Thank you.
Wonderful.
And
we have to remember, we can't wait for the politicians.
No, exactly. They, you know, in general, politicians, what they do is they wait for the parade to form, and then they jump out in front of it with a flag. We need to be the parade.
Oh,
so
we will blow them away.
Yep.
Thanks for everything.
Website for all this stuff, Jude? What's your favorite?
The key
I know afterdowningstreet.org will do it.
Okay, and campdemocracy.org, and they'll have a list of scheduling and how you can get in contact with people.
Perfect. Campdemocracy.org. Jude, thank you very much for the call.
Thank you,
appreciate
sir.
It. Patrick in Anchorage, Alaska. Hey, somebody listening in Alaska with their 2 cents on Stevens. I love it. Welcome to the program.
Hello. Love your show. I listen to you all the time up here.
Thank you.
Hey, I generally support Stevens on it, but, you know, I'm getting pulled both ways because, you know, partly the way Bush, you know, I really think he needs to be impeached and all. And
yeah, what you guys need to do is get a good Democratic senator who can bring home the bacon.
Well, and let's go to that. I mean, look at Senator Byrd when he was running the show. And if you look on that pig pork or whatever it was.
Yeah. West Virginia was making out like a bandit.
He was. And now West Virginia need a lot of roads, need a lot of infrastructure. You know, it's a mountainous state, you know. But for Pete's sake, you know, why can't Alaska start to build their infrastructure?
I don't disagree with you, Patrick, and that was my point. I all of us want our elected representatives to do the best for us and our interests, and
yes,
you know, it's a very parochial point of view, and frankly, I think it's unrealistic to expect that individual people are going to vote against a candidate who is benefiting them directly, even if it's not the very best thing for the country, unless it's some horrible thing for the country, you know, broadly
right,
speaking.
Right, I'm a mail carrier up here, and our union, you know, doesn't actively campaign against Senator Stevens because he has been good for the carrier union up here.
Right.
With rural mail and, you know, getting mail out to the Bush he's been good for us. So, you know, it's really hard for me to vote against the guy, you know, but I really am dissatisfied.
Well,
I'm sorry to say I voted for Bush, and I'm really sorry to say I did.
Right. Well, you know, we'll forgive you. I think that the larger issue here, Patrick, and it's the one that this conversation is really highlighting, is that I think all of us would agree it's fine if our elected representatives are acting in our interests and in the nation's interest. And there has to be some, there has to be some kind of flywheel. There has to be some sort of accountability, some certain level of transparency, so that the interests of the other 49 states are able to not suppress or crush,
right,
but at least balance the interests of any individual state, so we don't end up with a few powerful, generally men, who in Washington, D.C., who by virtue of secrecy and the ability to wield secrecy and one-party rule in at this point in time, although, you know, in the past there have been Democrats who ran all three branches and the Republicans were saying the same thing, aren't able to have an exclusive lock on the pork, shall we say. And,
right.
And this is where I'm really concerned about Ted Stevens, that he's gone over to the dark side. I mean, he's just...
I think he's the dinosaur in there, too, you know, and I think the Senate is evolving, and when he got mad and he had his hissy fit, you know, I'm going to quit, you know, because, well, that's the way things always went before, and now people weren't reciprocating. So he's on his way out, I do believe.
Well, from your lips to God's ears, Patrick, then, or to the voters' ears. Let's hope so. Thanks a lot for the call. Thanks a lot for listening to us there on KUDO in Kudo in Anchorage, Alaska. Right. Appreciate it. Well, we're wrapping up the show. We'll be back tomorrow. Thanks so much for being with me today, my friends. And remember, always remember, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Nothing's going to happen if you and I don't get out there and start getting active. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.